This is the Radio Check Podcast, life in the concert touring industry.
And once again, we are back. And it is a genuine pleasure, Chris. I can honestly say that this is one of the highlights of my week. Even though the listener's not seeing you, I see you and I love it. So it's good to see you, man. How are you?
It's kind of hard not to get, a sarcasm out of that, but I think you're actually being genuine. So thank you.
Of course. Of course. Well, I mean, maybe some of the listeners know the whole reason, and I will take credit on talking you into doing this podcast. It was self-serving. One was, wow, you know, what a great arena, no pun intended, for great stories and amazing people, but also an opportunity to, you know, spend some quality time with someone who is an extremely important part of my life, you know, not to get all mushy, but you are. And so, yeah. You know, I would have to say over the past 40 years, 95% of the time that I've spent with you has been in a production office or in catering. So this is,
well,
you know, the past 18 months has been.
You're 8 years younger than me. So you're just young enough. So I was able to change your diapers at one point. So that there is that window in there. So, you know, we have that intimacy as well. Yeah.
Well, I was lucky because, you know, and one of the things that I, kind of throw out there to some of the people to kind of give a sense of my background in this industry is you also taught me how to latch and unlatch cases and wrap a cable at about the age of 11 or 12. So, So this is the kind of stuff that when you learn it that young, that it carries with you for the rest of your life. It's burned into my psyche. When I see people's shoulder wrap cables,
those are important skills, no matter what you do in life. You know, I don't care what you do, wrap the cable properly.
Use your feet, pick shit up, straighten it out, use the gaff tape where it's needed, you know, a tidy area, wrap those cables, keep it organized, you know, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, well, on the other hand, you've taught me to lift with my knees, so that's good.
With the legs, driving with the legs, that is good, so. Yeah, but anyway, it's as much as I would like to turn this into that kind of podcast, but I am very interested in this one, simply because I don't know your history with this gentleman, but I know you did a little bit of an event with him, not in the near distant past here, just about a week or two ago. And from what you've told me, I'm really excited about this because I think, you know, not that we play in the same sandbox, but his concern over the well-being of touring professionals and mine, there might be an alignment there somewhere. So anyway, dying to hear the story in the background. And so what's going on?
Well, today we've got, a longtime production manager, production director, and the founder and president of the Event Safety Alliance and one of the authors of the Event Safety Guide, Mr. Jim Digby, coming from rural Pennsylvania. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Matt.
Welcome, man. Welcome. Yeah. How goes it? What's happening in Pennsylvania? Hey. What's keeping you busy these days?
Well, thanks for having me. That's for sure, man. I'm a first time caller, long time listener to the podcast, and I'm grateful to constantly get a chance to check in on some of the voices I have relationships with, and some that I've never had a chance to meet through your podcast, and some of the others doing similar work. All's quiet here on the Eastern Front in rural Pennsylvania. There's Amish horse and buggy territory to my west, and there's suburbia to my east. And my 12-year-old son and 9-year-old daughter have survived thus far during this crazy time. And my wife and I have learned to live with each other, with me in the house, as opposed to me away from the house. So I guess there's a bit of survivor's guilt around that. I'm happy to have discovered that it didn't happen overnight, right? Getting along with the wife didn't happen overnight. That took a little bit of time for me.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah,
I can see the guilt because, you know, being home, you know, I have an 11-year-old daughter and I've been doing half the heavy lifting, you know, I mean, where I didn't for the first 10 years of her life, you know, as work is approaching, I'm starting to feel the guilt coming on of, oh shit, you know, I'm going to have to leave this all to you again, you know? And I'm starting to feel that sense of urgency creeping in, you know?
Are you feeling like, man, do I really want to go back on the road again?
Oh, no, no. I really want to go back in the rut. I'm not saying that I'm dying to get away from my kid by no sense. Man. My relationship with my daughter is highly improved. It's different. Yeah. You know, there's a different dynamic now. I'm not that guy who's just home every once in a while, who's mainly there to, hey, let's go out to dinner. Let's have fun. Let's ride bikes. You know, I've become more of a disciplinarian, and I've become more of a, you know, a different figure in her life, you know, and I think that's good. You know,
I think for me, it was, you know, the rule we had in the house, and probably still do, I just haven't checked in on it, is, you know, listen, don't, I was expected not to be disruptive. You know, if I'm going away and only coming home every once in a while, what I can't do is come home and disrupt the order to the chaos that my wife has put into the house.
Right.
And, you know, so for a while I joked about, I put a guest sticky pass on when I got home and just remind myself that I was a guest in the home. And it's taken some time to learn that balance. My wife came out of retirement and did some work during COVID so that we could, you know, stretch the dollar a little bit longer. So, you know, there are blessings and curses about this break, but here we are.
Right. Right. Hey, well, you know, to get into things, you know, I want to make sure we spend, you know, as much as I want to talk about you and your career and, you know, all the great things you've done and, you know, and the, you know, the reputation that you've built for yourself. But I, you know, I think it's really important at this time, because during this break, we've all heard the word reset 1,000 times. And I think there's a lot of merit to that word. We are all kind of resetting, you know, whether it's in philosophy or approach or, you know, COVID-19 related stuff. But even well before the pandemic, you started the Event Safety Alliance, which, you know, in North America, in the States, not a lot of production managers were thrust into needing to know about that right away. All the Brits that are listening and all the, you know, British art that you've worked for or whatever, we've had to face up to that. And that is just real part of touring and tour building. You know, it's something that needs serious attention. And that's caught up over here, I think. You know, so let's talk about the Event Safety Alliance, the Event Safety Guide that you've authored. Why don't we go back to the beginning? What made you garner an interest in, you know, event safety, you know, to go as far as getting the Event Safety Alliance off the ground?
Yeah, happy to do so. Two minor corrections before we go down that road. I did not actually author the guide, and I was a co-founder of the formation of the Event Safety Alliance. And I think that's right. An important part of the story that we can get to, you know, starting back from the beginning, which I think is what you asked, Chris. For me, you know, I was bit by the entertainment bug when I was 9 or 10 years old in fifth grade, when I was made the master of ceremonies for the May Day parade and the technician as well. Jumped to a you know, university, going to college because that's what my dad wanted me to do in college, and I didn't fit. And then coming out of college into technical trade school, electronics trade school, which prepared me for a job opportunity that was in a nightclub that was being built in 1983, you know, during the heyday of Studio 54. And
in New York?
It was actually in the suburbs of Philly. It was about a half hour west of Philly. It was called Pulsations Nightclub. And it was built by some of the same companies that put the audio installation and the special effects installation of the 54 into the limelight. It's a massive project. It had 2,500 person capacity, and a transition from dinner theater to nightclub after dinner. The reason that story is relevant is I was 19 on that job, and I was a part of the technical installation of the lighting and special effects straight out of trade school, and I was also operating effects and playing lights in the DJ booth. And on the grand opening night, which was a press opening, 2,500 people in this place, the place was massive. It had a 22-foot diameter spaceship that tracked out from the back of the house. Wow. And delivered a 6-foot tall robot that came out of this spaceship, and girls could dance on the robot. And the robot was the host of the evening. And there were two shuttlecraft-like special effects that flanked this spaceship as it came from the back of the house.
Wow. Each way. I can see Grace Jones riding that right now.
Oh, for sure. For sure. These were these old aerodynamic police lights, these shuttlecraft. Anyway, on the big reveal, on the big moment, on the grand press opening night, I was, the ship came out, the shuttles came alongside of it, and I heard a scream about 8 feet from where I was standing. I turned to look to see that one of the 800-pound lighting fixtures had left the ceiling and gone through the skull of a girl right outside the DJ booth, and yours truly was pushing the button on that controller. The club operators and owners had cleared the effect to operate, but in reality, the contractors had not put the safeties in place, and they had not welded the steel plate on the end of the track. They had not put the safety switches that turn the engine off. It was a trolley drive motor, but they did come and say, it's everything's okay to run. Go ahead and run it. So I went ahead and run it right off the end of the track and through this girl's skull and attempted a brief bit of CPR, and that wasn't worth it.
Oh, wow.
So needless to say, that laid in some pretty heavy scar tissue.
What an awful thing to have to witness.
The club opened the very next night, believe it or not. And then it was shut down while an investigation was done into the operational protocols and such. And then when we came out of this moment, needless to say, we had implemented numerous safety checks that hadn't been getting done beforehand. So this idea of safety check before operation started at 19, alongside of the scar tissue. And then from there, I did some years at the club, and then I went down and worked at Disney in Orlando doing lasers and special effects and pyro. And of course that Disney experience is nothing but safety. And at some point in time transitioned to the live music business. So we a moderately successful career in the live music business, and we get to 2011, 2 years after my son was born, and he was born with complications that had this idea of mortality fresh in my head. And the Indiana State Fair collapse happened and 7 people died needlessly. I wasn't on that project, but I imagined myself in the wake of that project. Wow, what would I have done different? Could that have been me? What happened? How did we do that? This non-connected moment with my son and I were in the house one night, and it got quiet. It was just me and him, and it got quiet, and I couldn't find him anywhere in the house. And I finally found him. He was climbing the pantry shelves, going to find some food on the pantry shelves. And I waited for it. Because I did the only thing a dad does. I took a picture of it. And then he said, "Dad, can you help me get down?" And I said, sure. Not meaningless, right? I got him down. Got himself up, couldn't get himself down. But that night when I laid in bed, I thought to myself, those 7 people who died that day had an expectation of safety, and that was on us. And we failed them. And we failed them hard.
Right.
So that started this journey of discovery. Well, how did the failure happen? This is all just personal for me now. How did the failure happen? How could I train myself? Looked around, couldn't find any training for safety, couldn't find anything that addressed production professionals and the things that we need to do. And the only thing I could find was something put on by the International Association of Venue Managers called the Academy for Venue Safety and Security. So I put myself through that training. It was a week long, and met all these fantastic building operations guys and venue managers and venue security directors, and looked into this room and didn't see anybody who looked like me. I thought, well, why are there no production people here? That got some seeds turning. At the same time we were having phone calls, there was a working group that was maybe 1 or 2 people. Maybe it was Charlie Hernandez and maybe John Brown, and maybe it was even Lyle Santola in those early days. And then that working group went from 4 to 8, and then Dave Lester got on from Claire, and then Keith Bowen from, I guess he was a Tomcat at the time. And this group just kind of organically grew and was dissecting what had happened in Indiana. And it became clear that that group had, kind of some horsepower behind it. And maybe we should have an organization that addressed that particular failure.
Right.
The idea was hatched to create the Event Safety Alliance, and on the shoulders of all of those people who are involved in these kind of, even Mary Lou was there as well, you know, all those calls. Yeah. So we got to this place and we made an organization. And shortly after that, the Indiana governor at the time, Mitch Daniels, was going to enact some crazy rules around safety in the state, meaning saying things like, in an outdoor show, the first line of the audience had to be outside the fall zone of the stage. And it was going to really cripple the industry. So myself, our vice president and attorney, Steve Adelman, our executive director, Don Cooper, and a bunch of other people went up to Indiana and met with the governor and his people and said, hey, look, we've got this example from England called the Purple Guide. And we brought this subject matter expert from England, Tim Roberts of Tess. And we sat in front of the governor and his board. And we said, just give us a minute. We'll figure this out as an industry. We'll come back to you with something that's more meaningful than, you know, ad hoc decisions about how to protect people at an event. Ugh. Sorry, this is really long-winded.
It's okay.
Those were kind of the genesis days of the organization. Now, I knew nothing about starting a nonprofit, but charged down the road trying to do so. And, you know, 10 yeah. years
well,
later.
Well, if it's nonprofit, I mean, where did you find the funding to make it happen?
Good question. Very early on, our first supporters in IDEA were the entertainment insurers. And we had a very proactive group in Fireman's Fund. The director of entertainment insurance for Fireman's Fund, Lauren Bailey, and her team found us. We found each other because of a conference appearance we made, and we were holding up a draft copy of the guide, and we were talking about the work we were attempting to achieve. There was a really early supporter and a gentleman named Scott Carroll, who's now on our board of directors, and Scott saw us presenting at that, and he put us in front of the folks at Fireman's Fund, and Fireman's Fund gave us some seed money to get the organization going. You know, I wish we knew more than that we know now. Maybe that seed money would have been spent differently, more aggressively, but it was enough to get us to the guide. And the guide then became the body of knowledge we could fall back on and kind of splinter out and do other things.
That's you know, talk, you know, the guide, you know, it's the, you know, the safety event, safety guide,
right?
How often do you update that? Are you constantly learning new things and adding things and adjusting figures, or are you pretty happy with the way it is?
So very early on, we met Tim Roberts, and he came over with an authorization level letter from the health and safety executive in England, to saying that we could use the guide as a framework for this. So we dissected the team that did the actual writing. Steve Lemon was hugely instrumental in collecting the data for the guide. And also at the same time, the universe dropped this guy on me called Dr. Donald Cooper, who has nothing to do with the entertainment business, but he wrote fire code for the National Fire Protection Association in Ohio. And he was an Ohio, he was Ohio State Fire Marshal. So he had all the kind of missing components that we roadie production folks didn't have to get to writing guidance like this. And also very early on, we were talking with Lori Rubenstein at ESTA. At that time, it was Plaza. So we had some good bones to start the process of the guide. Steve Lemon went out and collected samples and collected writings from folks all around the industry, tried to digest those writings, because what we found in the process is many of us in the business have a lot of opinion, but maybe we can't write. So we got everything from napkin CAD to, you know, well thought out writing. And they were able to coalesce that. Steve and the team and Don were able to coalesce that into the guide. So iteration one, I think, was actually birthed around 2014. And we decided consciously about 2 years ago, maybe three now, and lost a year, probably four, in working in collaboration with ESTA, the Entertainment Standards Technology Association, I think, instead of writing a second version of the guide, we would take this version of guidance and put it through the American National Standards process. And the second iteration of this would be an American National Standard. And to date, we are now three of the chapters are now American National Standards. And, you know, we continue to work chapter by chapter through the process. It's a grueling process to get these things through. And there are working groups led by the Technical Standards Program that are dissecting this and sending it out for peer review. And then from peer review one, it goes out again. And so it's following a very regimented process. And thankfully we have ESTA for that, because DSA doesn't have the horsepower. It's an all volunteer organization.
Yeah, of course.
Except for one person who's the director of operations.
Right. Well, you mentioned the Indiana State Fair in 2011, which was kind of a weather incident. You know, we've had all sorts of accidents. You know, we've had accidents maybe, you know, due to weather, or, you know, you've got, you know, Radiohead in Toronto, which was, you know, negligence, you know, overloading a system with too much weight. You know, we've had building accidents, you know, with Edward Shirley stages with Madonna in Marseille and Los Angeles. And then we've had building structures fail, you know, like the Justin Timberlake in Atlantic City, where the roof just couldn't handle the weight. So there's so many different angles to look at safety via weather, via safe practices. You know, there's just so many different angles to look at it. So it's almost all encompassing. Being able to get your head around every angle of that is not an easy task. You know, you guys need to be commended for, you know, I don't know if you knew this journey was going to be this long and hard, you know, but you know, that old analogy that, you know, mountains are hard to climb, but the view's pretty good from the top, you know? So, you know, you've got a recognized document that is, you know, a go-to, you know, piece, a body of work and information, you know, and I can't stress to listeners just how important that is to our industry for us to have a guide. Nobody's guessing. Nobody's trying to, you know, figure it out on the fly. You know, these are tried and tested and calculated numbers, figures, and recommendations. You know, it's so important, man.
It's like pushing a mountain up a mountain, right? And you know, one of the band members that I worked with forever, you know, while commending us on the work, also said, "How will you know if you win? You know, you're trying to prove a negative. If everything goes well, is that because there was the work that you did, or is that because people got lucky?" Right. I mean, if you benchmark the modern day version of our industry back to the Beatles at Shea Stadium, and you look at the enormity of the kinds of things we've produced with zero guidance, zero professional designations in the way that we do our work, zero university academy learning of any kind whatsoever, zero accountability for safety standards at all, we've done pretty well. We've not offed a lot of people. Right. And we've built uniquely every time, because that's why the ticket buyers come. We wouldn't be building the same show every time because it was easy. So, you know, by and large, reputationally, we've done incredibly well as an industry. And we probably could continue to do incredibly well as an industry, but there's a different kind of accountability these days. And there's a different kind of human connection to safety these days. And there are other things falling down around us. And the last place we want people getting injured is at an event that's designed to make us escape those things.
Right, of course.
So, you know, you talked about, rightly so, Chris, you know, we took the project on around an event that weather was in the chain of causation, as was structural complications, as were ballasting complications, as were leadership complications. And oftentimes, rightly or wrongly, I don't suggest that weather is, you know, I ask people when we're trying to teach that moment, what killed those people in Indiana? And I ask it specifically that way. And you know, many say the weather, and many say, oh, the stage fell down. All of that is true. But the thing that we can impact and what killed those people in Indiana was the lack of an actionable plan, period. Right. There were all those other factors for sure. But we as an industry didn't at that time have an ability to talk to public authority and also, you know, go to peace with promoter and venue and artist. All of those different circles were making decisions in their own circles, and oftentimes they conflicted with each other. So there was no single point of truth for how we were going to evacuate that event in the right. in the face of weather. And we weren't collecting weather data from a reliable place. Just up the road, 90 miles away, just shortly before the stage fell down, the symphony was evacuated because they did the right thing and they had a plan and they could communicate across their audience.
Right.
A lot of mistakes were made. So the organization and the guide were born out of that moment. But as in each passing event that's happened, and you listed many of them, and there's also Christina Grimmie, there's Bataclan, there's Pulse Nightclub, there's and there's Vegas. Every time that happened, we looked for new subject matter experts. Where's the great work being done that's recognized internationally by smart people? We gathered those subject matter experts and we tried to get forward progress on what those teachings might be and either add it to the guide or park it for the next version of the guide.
Right. You know, well, there's the festival aspect of it, you know, where, you know, it's a standalone thing that needs to be, you know, a infrastructure needs to be created out of nothing, you know, but, you know, I'd like to talk more about as we're production managers and we build tours from scratch. You know, we are taking all the pieces from lighting, sound, video, set, bespoke set, automation, and we're putting all this together into a show and we're going to rehearse it and we're going to take it on the road. I think it's important for an outside advisor to do a safety analysis, which brings me to, you know, those catch phrases like method statements and risk assessments and these things that seem to be very important these days, which I feel are very important. Do you think a production manager should have the skills to write a method statement or a risk assessment?
Go ahead, Chris, sorry.
No, or should we be leaving this to the event safety shop and you know, outside safety specialists?
I think it's a combination of things. A well-learned production person would at least need to know that these things apply and respect that they apply and know who to call to get competent, reasonable safety information from. I'll back up just a second and say, you know, there's this idea of reasonable foreseeability and duty of care that we don't talk about in our industry. And that, you know, we had, and I didn't, this was something that came out of the incident in Indiana, was I didn't realize that I was going to be held accountable in a court of law as the production manager, because I held the duty of care for all of the elements that arrived with me in the trucks, including the humans and the buses, right? So as the person in charge, whether I recognized it or not, or signed a contract to that or not, as the person, the leader of that organization on the production end, that duty of care was mine. So that was one of these, oh my God, awakening moments. Heck, I got a kid now. I got a family I got to think about. I got audience members I got to think about. I got a professional reputation I have to think about. And then in defining what my duty of care is and how I will be judged to that duty of care, the second most important thing I learned was reasonable foreseeability. And that means I will be judged by the way my peers in the business do a same or similar task and what they hold themselves accountable to across a sampling of the business. Well, what the ESA has done as part of its byproduct is raise what is now reasonable. So reasonable used to be, we don't expect anybody to have any learned knowledge whatsoever about safety. So right. Now, because there's a guide, we've raised the bar on reasonability. So to answer your question about whether a production manager should be a safety expert, well, I would think in the future, yeah. I would think since the production person is carrying the duty of care, yeah.
Yeah.
We you know, the reason we wrote the guide is, I don't know if you've ever tried to read fire code, but it's impossible to read as a lay person who's a production manager who's not had any university. It's impossible. So we purposely crafted the language in the guide to be accessible and to be relatable. While we don't reference every type of event, how could you? The stuff we do reference, the guidance that's in there, is applicable to every type of event. You just have to think a little bit about how it applies to you. So yes, I think it's a combination of both to answer your question, who should be responsible.
Yeah. Well, I ask you that question because, you know, I've had this, I don't want to say argument, but I've had this conversation with business managers and artist managers about needing to allocate funds for proper safety analysis, you know, hiring the event safety shop to come into production rehearsals, talk to your crew chiefs, understand what the risks are, write an evaluation, look at your power schematics, do everything, make sure all the motors are certified, all these things, and then create a master document that the production manager has on his desk that, you know, hey, we've done our homework. You know, we know what we have. We know what we need to look out for.
Yeah.
I am lucky. I've got a lot of the people I work for allow me to do that and allow me to spend that money. Because at the end of the day, it's not that much money. And compared to what a lawsuit you could be facing, you know? Yeah. I mean, I heard you say this, or I maybe read it, and the statement is, it's more expensive to do it wrong, which I think rings out loudly, you know? It's really a heavy statement.
The scar tissue in me from 1983 will never go away.
Right.
And while I did not directly cause that to happen, I was in the chain of causation and I will never forget that. And there were other moments through life where things like that have impacted me. So the cost of doing it wrong, and it, you know, we can continue to behave as an industry in the way we currently do and see where that takes us. And I, you know, to some extent, great. Or we can spend a little bit of time, mental investment in learning how to do it a little bit better, or learning who to call. Method statements and you know, risk assessments are very important tools. But even we say plans don't save you. Having that book on your desk, that method statement on your desk, isn't what's going to save you. What's going to save you is the fact that you went through the process of planning. And hopefully you're smart enough to have done that with your team and you've gotten your team to buy into those things. It's the process of planning that makes us think about, oh, that leading edge is unprotected at 3 o'clock in the afternoon when we open the trap door to the elevator that goes 6 feet down to the toasters. And, you know, that local roadie doesn't know about that leading edge being unprotected. And he's just walked in and broken his neck. And now he's paralyzed mm-hmm. for life, right? What would that have taken to work out, you know, to risk assess and work out a mitigation plan for?
Right.
Nothing. Would have taken 10 minutes to figure that out.
Right.
But we as an industry don't embrace that by and large. Thankfully, many do, but we don't have a policy for it yet. And that's what we're intending to try to drive home.
Yeah, you brought up something about production managers, you know, having to take responsibility, or should I say liability. And I know you do this too. It's, you know, when you walk the arena floor in the morning, trusses are at head height, rigger's still in the air, shit's happening. And I've got to argue with guys to put their helmets on. That just drives me insane. You know, at the beginning of a tour, I put in a memo, everybody, I need you to wear a helmet during this period of time. If you don't have one, you need to go out and buy one now. Please don't make me have this argument with you. And yeah. I lay it out clearly. And I still, to this day,
yep.
Every morning when I'm out on the floor, I'm telling at least one person, most of the time two, hey, where's your helmet? Oh, sorry, dude. Sorry. It's right over there. Or it's on top of the dimmer rack, or it's on top of a case or something, you know, put on your helmet. And they think I'm being a hard ass.
Yeah. But
they've got to understand it is my responsibility. You know, when they smash their head, or when a shackle lands on their head, or a spanner or something, you know, if this ends up in court, I'm there, you know, I'm there, you know, and it's a responsibility. So, you know, I don't want anybody to get hurt, but, you know, I've got to, you know, we've got to protect ourselves. We've got to protect the tour. Do you remember what happened? You know, a production manager named Tony Gittins, British guy.
I do know the name for sure.
Yeah, yeah. He was doing production rehearsals, or maybe it's probably 10 years ago at Bray Studios in London with an artist who I won't name. But during the build, you know, they took a lunch break, one of the riggers, and I'm not 100% positive this is the way it went down, but as the story goes, went out and had a couple beers, came back, went up, harness on, didn't clip in, and fell to his death right in front of everybody in Bray Studios. You know,
that just happened at Coachella too, didn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. But you know, in Tony's case, the band threw their hands in the air. Wasn't us, you know, he's in court. He almost lost his fucking house. You know, it was an awful, awful thing to have to go through.
Yeah.
You know, but he eventually, you know, got out of it, but still, we are so liable for what's going on out there, and people don't see it. You know, again, I'll reiterate, I want to be safe. I want to be safe. I don't want anybody to get hurt, but still, you know, I've got our ass is on the line, you know, and maybe rightly so, you know, maybe rightly so.
Well, it's one of the challenges with the ESA from the beginning. And I think if I played any role in helping the industry, gain some traction, it was probably in the recognition that we cannot speak with a stick. We have to speak with a carrot, because knowing the industry the way that I do, I know that if we as an organization had gone out and wagged our finger, you can't do it like that, you know, and had been really admonishing people for doing it wrong, no one would pay attention to our organization. As it was, people were, you know, sure we were going to be doomed within a year. So we took the carrot approach. Look, we're just going to create the good guidance. We're going to create the reference. We're going to curate the reference material. We're going to do the hard work for the industry, and you build it, and hopefully some will come. And I got to tell you, Chris, sadly, there is not a great deal of folks that look like you and I coming to our organization. The majority of our the majority of our audience at our annual conference, which now is at 800 people, is insurers, corporate event producers, corporate event production companies, vendors and vendor production companies and the like. It's rare that we see production people from live music. And I'm not exactly sure why that is, but I know that I've heard it enough myself to say, I've been doing it like this to know that it may be, I've been doing it like this for 20 years. Why would I change now? I don't need that safety bullshit. Right? Right. And those are the deadliest words out there. And even I, you know, right after the advent of the ESA, well, our organization does something very different from ESTA, for example. You know, ESTA does the hard work of the technical standards. That's grueling work and grueling process. What we're doing is advocating for the culture of safety. We're trying to create the tools and lay them out for everyone so that the culture of safety can grow like it has in England. It's not a wind up in England anymore. It's the culture. It's baked into everything. So I conflated two ideas there. I'm sorry. Now I've lost my track.
It's okay. No. It's fine. Well, you know, I heard you say something else that I found really interesting. You know, we were talking about, it might have been on the forum you and I did recently, but you know, that essentially there are rules for construction sites. They're just are, you know, and they're there and everybody's got to follow it. I mean, everybody drives by a construction site all the time, you know, everybody's got high vis on, everybody's wearing a helmet. You know, there's one guy who's got a flag that waves traffic. I mean, it's, you know, there are rules and they have to follow them. Do you think we're going down that line where we have, you know, rules maybe based on, you know, ESA or the OSHA standard, you know, do you think that a guideline of best practices needs to be implemented in our industry?
Well, I would say, you know, and not for this to sound wrong, but do you think there shouldn't? You know, and the reality is, Chris, we already are beholden to OSHA, right? We already are beholden to the reasonable measures for safety in our industry. And, you know, what I've learned about OSHA, which I didn't know before this journey with the ESA, is that they're not going to come there and help me learn what I have to do right. They're only going to show up if we do it wrong. Yeah. And, you know, do it wrong to the state of we've sent three people to the hospital on the same day for the same type of injury, or we've killed somebody on the site, then OSHA is going to come and then it's too late. So it's up to us as an industry, you know, as I said, with the Governor Daniels story, you know, our goal then was to protect the industry from having some federal agency or state agency come in and say, no, now you're going to do business like this because you killed those people, which would have been decimating for all of us.
Right.
So part of the urgency for the ESA was to get a wall up there and create this go-to place where government could come to us. We then could filter on behalf of the industry and ensure that the government, you know, took our knowledge and subject matter expertise into consideration. So with respect to, you know, the construction industry, we're going to be judged on the worksite if something goes wrong by OSHA, no matter what. OSHA 10 and OSHA 30, general industry or construction, are trainings that are important to a different kind of industry from ours. But the fundamentals of what they train are, you can draw parallels to the work that we do. So the IATSE first created their own version of a entertainment specific OSHA 10 and 30. And now we, the ESA, have had one developed through one of our colleagues in supported by UC San Diego. So now the ESA offers an OSHA 10 and an OSHA 30 virtually that is entertainment specific. Right. And what does that mean? Well, it's the same OSHA 10 and OSHA 30. It just means we're going to draw parallels to the equipment we use and the work sites that we're on. And in fact, we're in a complicated lifestyle with OSHA because arguably when we're building a show and dismantling a show, we're the construction industry. And when we're operating the show, we're general industry. And we're judged by both of those standards, depending on what time of the day it is. And interestingly, as a construction industry, a fall from height, and I'm going to quote this and I'm going to get it wrong, but in the construction version of it, a fall from height, I believe, is 6 feet. In general industry, a fall from height, I believe, is 5 feet. And I know I'm going to get checked to death on this, but it could be 5 and 4, and I could have it backwards. But the two OSHA guidelines don't even align. So right. We're certainly not going to lower or raise the stage during showtime to meet. So we've got to create this pathway where an organization, much like ours, if not ours, helps the government to see that we are policing ourselves and we are trying to do the right thing and we are trying to keep people alive and we're aware of our hazards and we're putting in the controls that you suggest we need so badly. Because if we don't do that as an industry for ourselves, somebody's going to come and do it for us.
Yeah, they're going to. Well, I think they're, you know, I agree with you. There should be. And I think, you know, anybody who's building a budget for the future, there needs to be a paradigm shift in creating new line items in our budget for health and safety. They're there on mine, but I don't think it's commonplace enough. People need to take it seriously. And I don't want anybody to learn a hard lesson, you know, because there's going to be some hard lessons, you know, unfortunately, you know. So next I want to talk about, which something, another thing that's dear to you is showmakers, you know, it's the education platform. I think you started it off as a symposium and then now you've got an online presence and you're helping with education, not only in health and safety, but in, you know, in diversity and mental health and finances, you know, all the things that, you know, are outside of, you know, me teaching my brother how to wrap a cable or turn a butterfly latch, you know, these, the things that, you know, real, things that people need to get a handle on, you know, event safety, diversity, equity, financial, mental health, et cetera, et cetera. How did you come about that?
Did you tell your brother why he's not supposed to wrap the cable around his arm?
Well, it's you know, probably because it damages the cable, you know, whether it be the end or it twists the copper Or maybe maybe when you go to use it the next day, it's in knots. I mean, I don't know.
The reason I learned, and I've yet to hear anybody else say the same thing in film school, wrapping it around your arm and you get to a fray in the wire and it still happens to be energized. Now it's stuck on your arm and you're getting electrocuted. And you can't get it off your arm. There's a serious
That's what I told him, Matt. Isn't that what I told you?
You know, that's exactly what you told me. So yeah, that's it.
Showmakers was an idea, geez, now 6 or 7 years ago. It was born out of the idea that whether we like it or not, there's a stigma attached to the moniker roadies. I love it. I love the fact that I've been a roadie and I am a roadie and I'll always be a roadie. But there is, recognize it or not, a stigma attached to it to the outside world. And, you know, COVID has taught us that it matters what the outside road sees and who we are. And it matters on whether or not our skills transfer over to other industry. And it matters whether or not other industry says, roadie, what the hell's that? So initially, the genesis of the idea there was that perhaps we could start to kind of redefine ourselves. And in doing so, understand that, well, the skills that a roadie has applies to an esports event and applies to broadcast to some extent. It applies to theater. It applies across many different disciplines. But yet we are pigeonholed with a stigma in this one place. So the name was born with that in mind. There was going to be, in those early days, there was thought of a conference that was more rooted in education, and it was intentional that it would pick up where the safety discussion leaves off, because the ESA has a charter that's relatively specific to what it can do as a nonprofit. So Showmakers was born as a C3 nonprofit. ESA is a C6. It kind of harmoniously alongside of the ESA to pick up on all the other things that we might want to consider teaching ourselves that are not safety centric necessarily. Prior to COVID, I was putting the nuts and bolts in place with some early partners to have a live conference to do what I just described. The COVID came along the day or week before I was meant to be signing a deposit with my own good looks for a hotel in California for a conference. Thankfully, the travel rep was able to hold the hotel off. And a week later, the early vendors that were going to support the idea had pulled out. And it was clear that we weren't going to have a conference because COVID was going to decimate the industry. So very, very early on, well, what can we do with this idea? How can we continue to traction a little bit around the idea that our industry needs some education, and we could do that education ourselves, and we could find other people like us who want to teach and other people like us who have good ideas for things we should learn. And we recognized that mental health was going to be the first thing, I think, most concerning for our industry. We're already fragile humans in our industry to begin with, because the way we burn the candle at both ends. So with the help of some other folks, we launched a podcast that was intended to kind of address the mental health hammer that we were just hit with because of COVID. And it evolved week to week. And eventually we didn't really script it. It was too loose because of me. And we got to this place where week to week, we found that we were doing the same things. Like, I was baking sourdough bread. So was another person baking sourdough bread. And then we were having this remorse, and then we were having this other high. And so this mental kind of journey that we were on resulting from COVID was running parallel with other people. So we just kind of talked that through week to week. And about 11 weeks into it, everybody involved was saying, you know, it's feeling like we've kind of exhausted the truth to what we were trying to do. And now we may just be making it up to have a podcast. And we made the decision to not do the podcast anymore. So then what else can we do? Found some additional partners, started talking about other ways Showmakers could be useful. The George Floyd moment happened, the tragedy, awfulness happened. That was impacting our mental state. Sorry, that's actually me. That never happens. Nobody ever calls me. It was impacting our mental
state. Get used to it.
So this was happening. These other things in society were happening, this geopolitical thing that was going on, impacting our mental state. So we started picking up on that conversation. The DEI conversation was getting louder and louder, and we wanted to try to be helpful there. So opened up some dialogues with roadies of color. And then Noelle Skaggs came in with her Diversify the Stage project, and that was taking some traction. So, you know, suddenly many of us found ways to occupy our COVID time trying to do good things. And I think what we decided early on was that let's just amplify everybody who we think is, you know, out there really trying to do something good, and as opposed to trying themselves to stay relevant. You know, there was a, we kind of tried to make a boundary between what we would amplify and what we wouldn't amplify, and tried to find some justifiable means to say, oh, that's really good work over there. They're really trying to do something. Let's amplify it. So we also were able to do some of that work with NAMM, which was interesting. We just did another NAMM session last week in Nashville, where we, you know, had this learning outcome of 2 days of teaching where we took somebody who's never been in the business before and walked them through different elements of what it's like to be in the business. And then on day two, walked them through safety elements of the business with the hope that this might become a program that helps feed the pipeline, which is woefully short right now. So the challenge with running not just one nonprofit, but two, is that nonprofits need resources, and that you can only call on your friends and colleagues to do volunteer work for so long. So we're kind of at this place right now with Showmakers, not with ESA, but we're kind of at this place with Showmakers where without real funding, it's untenable. It was funded by me principally for the little bit of things that we were paying for. I still think it's a great idea, but we've run out of resource at this point.
Oh, that's a drag. I mean, I see on the Showmakers website. I have it open here in front of me, and just what is being offered right now, I couldn't be illuminated anymore. Everything on there, you know, people are struggling with their finances, people are struggling with their mental health, you know, people are trying to figure out ways to get back on the road safely in a possible, you know, good frame of mind, ready to work, ready to do a good job, you know? You know, but this kind of, you know, leads us down another path, you know, about how we feel about, you know, general health, mental health, as in physical health, you know? I'm starting to talk to my brother, Matt, a lot about this, and to other touring professionals a lot about this on, you know, along with mental health, how do we keep people healthy on the road? How do we make it a better experience for them? How do we make it, you know, where they can, you know, work long hours and still feel good? You know, I mean, is there ways to feed them better? Are there ways to help them get better sleep? Are there ways to, you know, relax the anxieties that they might be having, you know? How do you feel about that? I'm spending a lot of time thinking about that personally.
Yeah. There's two parts to that, right? There's the elevated risk element that we're in right now, that the insurers all, you know, are talking to the ESA about. And that is, you know, we've lost our instinctive and our intuitive muscle memory, with all this downtime. So the things that a rigger might do instinctively, or a bus driver or a fork driver or a stagehand, those senses are kind of dulled. So there's this, we worry that for the next year or so, we're in this elevated high risk, just trying to do the job, because the tenor of the work space hasn't changed any. And the demand for 7 p.m. doors and 8 o'clock show start hasn't changed any. That constrainer is still the same. And therefore the people component that bring us to the 8 o'clock doors or 7 o'clock doors, they're all really super rusty, and trying to just keep up and trying to put money back in their bank accounts. And they may forget something that causes catastrophic outcome. So there's that component that we're really worried about. And the more we talk about it, the more we hope to have people understand, to be on the lookout for each other in that regard. But I think with respect to the mental health component, you know, as with most of the mission cause-based stuff that I get my hands into, there's a personal connection. I lost the artist I worked with to death by suicide. I worked with him for 16 years, a few years ago. And that was earth shaking for me. It was earth shattering and for his family and for everybody else and for the world really, because he was such a great talent.
Yes, absolutely.
But so what I did in response to that again was go look for learnings. My kids knew him. They had the opportunity to be with him around the stage, and he treated them kindly, and it was the first band they ever knew. And I was worried about their mental health as a result of what he did and how we would tell that story. So I took the mental health first aid training class for youths in 2018 or 2019. In a gather my resources and protect them kind of thought process to protect my children. And now where we are, thanks to the Behind the Scenes charity, we have this highly acclaimed, you know, 2-decade-old program called Mental Health First Aid that was developed in Australia in 2000 and has some 4 million people now trained in it. Thanks to Behind the Scenes charity, we now have a program that's again entertainment specific. It speaks to the event professional. We are, our tribe, if you will, is living on the edge of mental exhaustion at all times. And then we go on this roller coaster ride when the house lights go out and we get our chills, we get a little shot of cortisol, adrenaline, you know, dopamine, and we have all these natural highs happening in the work that we do. So here we are, you know, doing this natual high roller coaster, and then if you're in a bus, the curtain closes, you're in this silo by yourself. So many or some number of our colleagues, myself included back in the day, would chase that naturally, you know, derived high with other ways to get high. So we have this natural state of being, which drops our acuity. We don't eat well, drops it even further. We don't sleep well, drops it even further. And we have these compounding effects to our mental strength. And then we get in this cycle of lather, rinse, repeat, because it becomes the only way to survive from day to day.
Right.
Which is not healthy. And it leads to the kinds of outcomes that we see. And now you have COVID take away not just our job, but our identity, because we're one of those workforces that our identity is drawn from the work that we do.
So true. So true.
So we're all like, you might as well just be hitting us with 5-pound sledgehammers all day long with the compounding effects that we're in. Now we're going to go racing back to work and we've forgotten how to do the job and the goals are still the same and the managers are still the same pressure and there's little space for compassion and empathy around these ideas. And all everybody wants to do is just get the doors open and then shit goes wrong. So I think first you gotta name it to claim it, right? So let's say that problem out loud. This is our problem. This is what we have to face. What do we do about that? Well, guys like you and me and Matt can look for ways to inform our colleagues that these are stressors you should be aware of. And just like not failing from a heart attack, some of the same things you do to stay away from a heart attack help your mental health: sleep, food, exercise. And the idea of mental health first aid training for our industry is just that. It's triage, it's CPR. You know, what's said in the class when teaching this is you are more likely to help somebody with your mental health first aid training than you are to be pumping on somebody's chest because they've just had a heart attack. The numbers of cases that we see around these things.
Correct.
And this is evidence-based training, and it comes with a 3-year certificate backed by the National Council for Mental Wellbeing. So if that's the triage, sorry, Matt.
I just actually finished that training 2 weeks ago.
Did you appreciate it?
Oh yeah, it was fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't mean to cut you off. I mean, you're on.
No, that's okay.
I just happened to do it myself. So.
We just delivered it July 14th, first time in person to our colleagues, and it went over really well. And it's a completely different experience doing it in person, but. So we're now saying out loud, well, mental health first aid is triage. That's great. That's reactive. What do we do that's proactive? Which I think is where you're coming in, Matt, and where Zach and Chaim and the Bohr and Newman Associates, the white paper, the guys that wrote the white paper, and Janine Diaz, and so many people are doing such great work around the proactive measures we can take. Can we set up inside a workspace, a quiet zone, a safe zone? Can we encourage people just to take 5 minutes for themselves and breathe? Can we make better offerings at catering? You know, can we just slow down the background noise? Can instead of our vendor leaders, our sales reps showing up on a show site and going, come on, everybody, follow me to the bar. Maybe they can show up on a day off and take us hiking. You know, because all they're doing when they say follow me to the bar, which is fun, don't get me wrong, I like that too, but it's enabling this cycle of destructive behavior.
Yeah.
And so we have, it's a huge problem, just like the safety guide, Chris, I'm sorry.
I know, but you know, again, your points are valid. What we do is hard. We work long hours. There's the mental aspect of it. You need to stay on top of things. You know, you're away from your family. You know, those things are hard. That's hard enough as it is right there. Let's not add to that. You know, I mean, you know, eating poorly, drinking a lot on your day off, not getting restorative sleep is just compounding on top of what's already an above average difficult, you know, atmosphere. You know, so I'm trying to introduce my brother Matt further into the industry, and he's starting to make headways. You know, like ideally, you know, Matt's going to have a video or a movie that we can share with everybody before the tour, or you know, maybe I can have him come in and hang around in pre-production and talk to people, and maybe address everybody in a group. Or you know, I would really like to. You know, you can't force people not to go to the Irish pub on their day off and go there for
lunch.
We
need the decompression.
Stay through dinner.
Yeah.
You know, we can't tell it, but you know, but again, you know, there are better ways to treat yourself. And again, just make people aware of it, you know.
Yeah. Give people choices.
Like Matt, maybe you can, you know, I know you've said it on the podcast before, but I think Jim would love to hear this. Just, you know, ways to get better sleep, you know.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. And certainly I want to add to so much of that conversation. You know, certainly there, you know, the industry has its, you know, background, right? You know, sex, drugs, rock and roll. And then it kind of led into this mindset of this personality that's just hard to shake. But people are starting to recognize that change is needed. And it's great to say all these things that, you know, oh, how to get better. You know, you need to get better sleep. You need to eat better and all those things. Yeah, but how? And you know, I've been doing this for over 20 years, and everybody's formula is a lot different. And so it's talking to them in a way, and you know, trying to get into like pre-production would be a dream scenario, because you get to know people and then you give them, you know, some areas to focus on. And again, it depends on the role that they play on the tour. You know, just to answer Chris's question associated with sleep. I mean, the science around sleep right now is amazing. It's not just why it's important, but strategies on how to best get it, you know? And the thing is that every 99% of the people on the globe in civilized Western civil, you know, populations, they shoot themselves in the foot every night, every time they go to bed. There's three main things that they do is they're drinking alcohol, or they're doing drugs, or they're eating crappy food, and they're sticking a bright screen in their face. And all of those things are so disrupting to the circadian rhythm. And so I'm doing an event next week on sleep and jet lag, discussing these things and how best practices for people in the touring industry in order to get better sleep. But it's going to be a significant paradigm shift into what they've ever known as far as how they behave and how they go about their business. And, you know, the thing is people are like, well, how is food going to change my mental health or affect my sleep? It's like, whoa, just you can get me wound up on that stuff, because we're talking about not because food isn't just calories. You know, there's inflammation aspects, there's hormonal impact and all the things associated with blood sugar swings, which is going to affect someone's mental health. And, you know, and the idea of being able to respond to a situation and not to react to a situation and the sleep. And I mean, there's all of this stuff comes together in very subtle ways that can change someone's world. and change their behavior and make the workplace happier and healthier and safer. Because everything that you said much earlier in this conversation, it's like when you're exhausted and, you know, all these things, the synapses aren't firing. You know, you're working at a decreased capacity because of how you feel your body and how you rest it. And, you know, looking at professional athletes, you pick your favorite sport, team, athlete, whatever, if they compromise in any of those areas and they get on the field, they're not going to be at their best. They might get lucky, but they're not going to be at their best. And they get paid a lot of money. Well, so do a lot of touring professionals. And especially if you want to do this for the long haul and you want to take this into a career that might span decades, you got to pay attention to this stuff. So my job is to create resources on how. And I'm really looking forward to the opportunity. And as terrible as the pandemic has been for everybody, I mean, I've been looking at this for years. And just, you know, it's the way I kind of look at it is that if I tried to do this without a pandemic, it would be like trying to change a flat tire in a truck while it's still rolling down the highway. So the fact that it's kind of the pandemic slowed everybody down and we're having these conversations and the curtain's been pulled back on people's struggles, mental health, and their fears. And I love what you said about, you know, helping people with finances. I mean, I work with dozens, hundreds of people that are professional financial educators and advisors. So maybe there's a connection there. I don't know.
But yeah.
Anyway, as Chris knows, I can just go and go on this stuff. It's definitely in my wheelhouse. It's my passion. And I can't wait to get some resources out there.
We can't plug or underscore this topic enough, you know. It's real stuff, you know, and I'm paying attention to it and I can feel the difference in my life. I'm really looking forward to putting some of these practices that you've taught me and that I've figured out on the road to see how I feel, you know, because, you know, sleep is the most important thing to me, you know, and it's the thing that is hardest to get on the road, you know, between the disciplines of, you know, you slept late into the day after a long loadout, and then but you've got to go to bed early that night to get up early the next morning. You know, all these disciplines that we and struggles we have with sleep, there are ways to make it easier on yourself. And you're like you were saying, you know, screens and drinking and are absolutely the wrong way to go about it. I don't know. I would hope that people would listen to this message and give it a try, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I would love to see people on the road not only doing good work, but being happy in that good work, you know. I think it's important.
I go back to education is the key, right? And it's not, it may be not for everybody, but I know one of the ways we approached the Road Ready program that we just did at SummerNAM was, what are all the things you would wish you wish somebody had told you before you got in the business? And we identified some of those markers and put the program together. Because I know myself that everything I know, and probably for you too, Chris, everything I know about the business, I know because I got either hit over the head with a shackle, or I tripped in the hole, or, you know, I didn't have any money when I came home after tour. So they're all schools of hard knocks. It's all on the job training. And gosh, if I had known what I know now, then I'd be retired. I'd be teaching, period. That's all I'd be doing. So I think our, you know, our self-given mandate, and it sounds like this is where you might be going too, Chris, and certainly where you are, Matt, our self-given mandate is, let's put the education out there so that the new people getting into the business, or even some of the old ones, can recognize, like for me, it was eye-opening to think, to connect the dots between adrenaline, cortisol, and dopamine when the house lights go out, as being this self-given high, and then the high I would chase, right? That was that was life-changing for me because it helped me identify the problem. So I think we're in this place, Matt, that your work sounds incredibly interesting. There's a lot of people I'd love to connect you to. And as you correctly said at the beginning, we're all manufactured differently. So there can be hundreds of people approaching this problem and providing opportunities on this problem to learn and do better. And one size isn't going to fit all. So I'm glad there's you. I'm glad there's the Rody Clinic, for goodness sakes. They're doing incredible work. Janine Diaz and Boris, there's all these different people working in this space, and that they aren't homogenized because we aren't homogenized. So applause, kudos to you, Matt. Keep up the good work, man.
Well, just one strong point on there is education's one thing, support's another. Because people, you can educate and talk all you want, but if you're not there to support, you know, when they have questions or when they hit a snag, they got to be picked back up. They got to be helped along the process, because there's a, you know, when it, like food and even sleep, like staying up late, these are behaviors that we developed when we're young, and they're habits, and they are, there's an aspect of comfort to it. And I'm not trying to rip that away from anybody, but we have to know that, you know, these things that can be very nefarious, and they need the support. And they, like, I love that you use the terms like, you know, empathy and compassion, because this is hard stuff, and people, everybody's struggling. Everybody. I see it all the time. And that's the whole reason I do what I do. You know, I guess on that note, I just have to say, it's like, yes, that tragedy you had when you were 19 years old is like absolutely terrible. But if it didn't happen, you wouldn't be who you are today. You know, and you wouldn't be doing what you're doing right now. And I have a very similar message. And, you know, I went through that, you know, trial of fire, and I'm here because of that. And as terrible as it is, anyway, but, you know, I have to say thank you for your work as well.
It's the stuff that gets in our DNA. I'm going to add a third problem to that, Matt, to the way you just dissected it, which is correct, right? The third component to where we could fail is, you can come out and do all this prescriptive work. You can do all this proactive work and get the team set up for success and individualize everybody's nuance. So one person's listening to music before they go to bed, you know, whatever the journey is, you do all that really hard work. But if you hand the keys over to the race car driver, who's a train wreck of a leader, then all that work goes out the window, because that leader doesn't respect it, and that leader doesn't understand it, and he doesn't support it, and he doesn't create the room for people to have that peace. Right.
Yeah, so that's true.
So one of the hopeful outcomes of where I'm still heading, partially with Showmakers, is creating better leaders in this space, or providing the education to get to better leaders in our space. Because we are, by and large, we're all of the leaders that you see, and all of the great ones, and all of the maybe, you know, a little bit less than great, and all the generations are all on the job trained leaders. And microaggressions have been a thing, that's the way some of them lead. And I think in my analysis, which is not scientifically based, that maybe that's because we know we got nothing to back it up other than our tenacity. And so to protect ourselves, when we feel like we're going into a corner, or when somebody doesn't do what we ask them to do, or something goes wrong and it looks like people might start looking at the leader, we get really loud and really big and really aggressive. And that's really hurtful for a lot of people around those leaders. So we need better leaders that can support this mission.
I agree.
You know, one last thing on that, in my experience, the best leaders are the ones that, listen, you can teach someone, and if they don't believe in it, it's going to be half-assed. And they might do it because it's, you know, they were told to do it, or they're being paid to do it, but they have to have skin in the game. So I know it's, give me any leader, and it's like, okay, where's your weakness? You know, where is your dysfunction? You know, let's fix that. And they're like, wow, that really worked. Well, now they're bought in, and now they're going to push the agenda a little bit more. So, anyway, it's awesome. It's awesome stuff. So,
yeah, I want to stand up and clap my hands now. This has been really good stuff. But, but Jim, you know, you and I have been like ships in the night for the last 30 years. You know, we know of each other. I think we've spoken a few times, but, you know, I'll be honest, you know, you're, you know, a guy that's been out there that I really don't know a hell of a lot about. And I wouldn't mind, you know, learning a little bit about your story. And you know, you told us a story about nightclub and early on, you know, learning about electronics and teching and whatnot, but what are the happenstance or the steps that got you on the road for the first time, if you don't mind?
Wow. Really? That's the one you, as I said, college and I didn't fit. And I have always been that nerd at school. I got through junior high because of my work on the theater and in the television studios. I was blessed to be in a good school district in that way, where they had an arts program. And, you know, I was a laughable student at best, academically. But man, I knew I was in this environment, and that environment turned me on and made me excel. That parlayed into the nightclub story, that parlayed into the Disney story, that parlayed into a film school story. And then I had a roommate who, just after I finished film school and was still working at Disney, he got an opportunity to go on the Bill of Rights tour, which was a celebration of the 200th anniversary of the first 10 amendments to our Constitution. And we carried around one of the original parchment handwritten copies of the Bill of Rights, along with an 11 truck arena scaled show that was a museum tour. And the audience would come in and get the chance to see the parchment copy. And they would learn about the Bill of Rights and its impact. So that was the first tour. And that tour was taken over by Morris Lyda in very early days. So Morris.
Really? What year was this?
1989, I think. It was just on the run up to Iraq One. So it might have been 1990, somewhere in there.
So he was kind of on the road by then. I remember back in the late 80s, he had a nightclub in Austin. And I remember meeting him. It was the first time I met Morris Lyda. Anybody who doesn't know Morris Lyda, Genesis, Pink Floyd. I mean, he's like one of the big production managers of, going back to the days of Bill Graham and Joe Baptiste and Michael Ahearn and all these guys. He was one of the original super production managers.
Yeah. With a larger than life personality. And I think he was also a bull rider or a rodeo clown or something along those lines before he got into the entertainment business. And if I got my story correct, he was also John Belushi's right-hand man for a period. So this was trial by torch, not trial by fire. I mean, I can't think of a good analogy to a massive hot fire, but that's what it was like working with Morris. And it was great. These were great lessons because there was this constant sense that you were going to get your ass kicked if you didn't get it right. And my first rock and roll tour was the Genesis Stadium tour in 1992 with the first ever touring video screens.
Wow.
And it was mayhem. And I got beat up. I had no business being there. And the backline guys chewed me up and spit me out every day. And they had me chasing case numbers that didn't exist at the top of loadout, screaming at me for not showing up with those cases. And they never, it was a real journey. I stayed with Morris and all that he did for about 5 years. Somewhere in there, my dad passed away. And that was crushing for me. I was away. I was in Belgium and he wasn't ill. It wasn't meant to be. And he passed of a heart attack, and that was devastating for me because he was everything. And that put me on a kind of hiatus for about a year. I went back, worked for Bugsy after that, did some Bon Jovi advanced stage managing, site coordinator stuff.
Right.
And I've just,
What a guy to learn from.
Yeah. Wow, Bugsy. Golly, man, what a lovely person he is.
And a true gentleman.
Yeah, he called me in to stage manage, nighttime stage manager for Woodstock 99. So there was, I had this really tumultuous period where I was doing every show that ended in riot or fire or mass fights. I was a part of.
I was there for the Chili Peppers. That was mine. So yeah, I remember the fires on the horizon from stage where it was.
Yeah.
Shocking, yet somehow incredibly thrilling.
Yeah, I was on the main stage when the fires broke out, and the Alamo, the last stand at front of house, right, and pushed over the front of house, the delay towers, and set everything on fire. And yeah, that was crazy. And then I did some work with Gary Lanvey during the MTV Unplugged series. I was around for some of those really. Hallmark moments of the MTV Unplugged series.
Another great man.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Man.
Still at it.
Still at it. I still hear from him every once in a while. And I did Fashionably Loud with him also for MTV. And then at some point I did Hootie and the Blowfish for Jim Brammer, and did that, the Cracked Rear View and Fairweather Johnson tours with those guys. She's a blues traveler for a little bit, thanks to Howard Hopkins. Then the Horde Fest. You really want all these?
Well, you know, I'm trying to get an idea of
who my mentors were.
It sounds to me you weren't into lighting or sound or anything. You pretty much got into stage management, coordination. You know, you learned that end of the trade.
Well, it's funny because my go-to skill, my actual tradecraft skill, is automation and electronics and that sort of thing. And in fact, I played lights at that nightclub for a while, but I never did it in rock and roll. So when I failed miserably as I think a second stage manager on that Genesis tour, Morris shifted me back to my sweet spot, which was automation, which I did for some Phil Collins tours. He sent me over to live in Japan for nearly a year doing a Japanese artist he and Mark Brickman had put a show together for. And so I had some real great opportunities thanks to those guys and thanks to Howie Hopkins. And then I started to kind of carve out my own name and my own reputation. Went on to work with Blues Traveler and...
Where were you first a production manager? Where was the first time you were a production manager?
I think that was Hootie in 95, I think. And then I didn't look back from there, really. I just kept going.
Right. So, and then, I had Pooch on the show recently, and I kind of said to him, I said, people know Pooch. It's like they think Linkin Park. And it's kind of the same thing for you, you know. People hear the name Jim Digby, they think of Linkin Park. And you mentioned earlier, your relationship and your family's and your kids' relationship with the band and of course with, Chester passing and whatnot. What an incredible organization, you were there 16 years, which is a testament to how good it must have been. They've sold over 100 million records. I mean, they are a worldwide phenomenon, kind of almost the leaders in that genre of rock or metal or however you genre-less. But what an incredible organization. It was them.
I was doing Marilyn Manson before that opportunity. And during my time with Manson, I was also doing the Bolshoi Ballet. So I'd do like come off of Manson, my head's just, and then I'd have this stint with the Bolshoi Ballet and I'd get all soft and warm and juicy. And then I'd have to go back to Manson. But somewhere along the line, there was an opportunity. It was actually thanks to Chris Groton. He pulled me in to cover for him in a moment in time. He had two or three artists that he was working at the same time. It was at the end of their very first album cycle, I believe, when that happened. And when the next album cycle spun up, they made, the choice that I was going to get the phone call. Chris and they put some distance between Chris and I, because I think Chris thought that I consciously had something to do with it. But we've healed that, and I never look back. In a lot of ways, the reason that journey lasted 16 years, and I grew up in that band, I became more of a professional in that band because my behavior was, still old school rock and roll when it started, and it evolved every cycle. But I think one of the reasons we worked together well was that they, all six of them, saw the business as a business from the very beginning. They were no nonsense guys. There was very little outside influence. There was very little enabling going on. They were really, really business oriented guys. And because I had that kind of weird theater, Disney film kind of juxtaposition in my career, Disney really hits you with show quality. And to Disney, show quality is everything from taking your sunglasses down when you're talking to an audience member to everybody picks up trash. So that thread of show quality came in the Linkin Park show. And for a while, it was tenuous between me and the rest of the team because not all roadies see show quality the same way.
Right.
But eventually we grew a team that more truthfully represented, I think, who the guys were and what the guys wanted out of their professional technicians. And we were lucky to have a long journey together.
Right. You know, such a success, you know, and it's a shame with Chester, and it's, you look at Chester, you look at Chris Cornell, you look at Anthony Bourdain, you know, I mean, yeah. I mean, there's a common thread there. They all, you know, struggled with drugs at one point in time, and then, you know, they all took their own life. And I think there's certainly a lesson there, you know?
And I think the other thing we know now, you know, of course, that was one of the most painful parts of taking the mental health first aid training, was learning some of the signs that were clearly there that I didn't know how to read. But what mental health professionals know is that oftentimes this pain that that these folks are trying to shut off is born of a childhood trauma of some sort, and that these, you know, the developing brain at up to an age, and I'm not a professional, so I can't really say what it is, but I know that the developing brain up to a certain age in life, if it gets impacted by some significant trauma, be it physical or mental, that tissue never really comes back the same. And it's one of those places where the demons come in that childhood drama.
Wow,
and it's really hard to excise them as you get older in life. And one of the iterations of mental health trauma is, you know, drug use or other addictive behaviors to quiet the noise or to quiet the trauma from something in the past. And it's, you know, it's really a goddamn shame that we as a society don't know how to fix that, you know, and in fix it, I mean, how can we stop kids from having trauma, you know? And then, and then what's the scientific work if they do, you know, let's minimize those numbers first. And then let's also find a solution so that if, God forbid, someone does have a trauma at a young age, how can we help them lead a normal, healthy life?
Right. You know, it's so true. You know, I listened to, you know, going back to Linkin Park, I listened to Mike Shinoda's podcast with Rubin on Broken Radio. And I really didn't know much about Mike Shinoda, but man, that dude just fucking blew me away. You know,
he's
a fucking cool dude. What a clever dude. What a giving person. You know, I'm a fan of him as a human being, you know, as an individual, you know, can't say enough about, you know, how impressive that guy is.
You've raised the hair on my arms, Chris. Thanks for bringing him up. He is one of a kind, and in all the best ways. And he is a creative genius. He's a musical genius. He's an artistic genius. You know, this is me, an unqualified source, saying all these things, but I've been on his shoulder from his first solo project to the last. And I watch who he genuinely is with us. I watch who he genuinely is with his family. I watch who he genuinely is with his art, and the respect level for all of the, and his audience, for God's sake, the respect level for all of those things is so true and so genuine. You know, on the heels of Chester's passing, he wrote an album called Post Traumatic. And I think part of that may have been encouraged by Rick Rubin, who said, just keep writing, you know. And he got the whole journey of coming out of Chester's death into music, or got major elements of it. I shouldn't say whole, I don't know. But he got major elements of coming away from that moment into this record. And then not just put it into music, wrote it, produced it, and then put it on the road and took it around the world as a to attempt to connect back to the fans and help them heal. You know, we were so worried in the early days after what happened with Chester that many of the fans might see that as a permission giving moment. And thankfully, because of the way the band and the band wives specifically handled messaging after it, we did not see that occur. You know, the reason that was a concern was the audience that connected to that band is an audience that connected to the disconnect that the music spoke about, right? It's the pain that the music spoke about. So there was good reason, in my mind, there was good reason to be concerned for our fans, their fans. So Mike writes this tremendous piece of work, tremendous art on Post Traumatic. and then takes it around the world and says, hey, y'all, man, I hurt too. And I know you hurt and I'm here for you. And, you know, what do you want to do tonight? Do you want to sing? And it was, I'm tearing up just talking about it. It was the most cathartic journey I've ever been on.
Wow.
And to watch him deliver that night after night with the same genuineness was just really something special.
Wow. This is my second standing ovation moment for this podcast, you know, very well done. So, so good. And when, you know, I love when, whether it's our industry, you know, maybe it's the work, maybe it's the music, maybe it's the relationships, the personalities that makes us feel just like the way you feel right now. And it's such an honor and a privilege to be able to do what we do and to be, you know, in front of that, you know. Yeah. And there's a lot of reasons to love what we do for a living, you know, there's a lot of it. And that's absolutely one of them right there, man.
That's absolutely. It. I mean, that to me, you know, I said earlier about that we're a unique workforce, that we're defined by the work that we do. That's the, in my view, that's the best definition, right? That's nice. I will never say I'm sad about being defined by my work or that I shouldn't be defined by my work. I'm blessed.
Yeah. It's who we are.
Yeah.
It's who we are. It rich really is, you know.
And that kind of servant leadership, that the idea that we serve an artist. Man, I've never wanted to be on stage. I've only wanted to serve an artist.
Same here.
So
same
cool. Here.
Hmm. Hey, so you know, one last question before I leave. It's time to go back. We're going back to work, and we talked briefly, or you mentioned briefly that you know, it's going to be a slow start. You know, people need to get their head back in the game. The muscle memory won't come back as easily, you know, as it did. There were things that you and I or a lighting crew chief or a backline guy did instinctively that we're going to have to stop and go, huh, I know I used to do something in this very moment, but what was that again? You know, but it'll come back. It'll come back. But I want to talk to you more about COVID, you know, unfortunately. I hate talking about COVID because personally, I'm over it, you know. The vaccine's available. Get it. And if you don't get it, you know, I'm not so sure where my empathy lies, you know, anymore, you know, mainly because I'm just so frustrated that our industry has been decimated for so long that, but still, even though, you know, there are variants that are coming out, it's still, even though I think our business is still full steam ahead, I don't see it throwing a speed bump in it. We're still going to have to take precautions, insisting that our crews are vaccinated, creating a bubble, maybe creating zones, you know. And I think a lot of us learned something, what happened to the Foo Fighters at the forum. You know, I spoke to somebody who was on site and it was a free for all, you know, no masks, no zoning. Everybody was doing what it was like back to normal behavior. And it was just came too soon. And you know, show got canceled, ended up loading out, you know, and I think that hurt us all. Just the fact that that happened hurt us all. It has set us all back, all of us, you know. Do you have any comments on, let's use that word, best practices, you know, maybe moving forward, you know, what are some things that you're thinking, or maybe you've learned, or, you know, what is a production manager need to do in his planning stages before he even opens the first truck, you think, COVID wise?
Wow, Chris, you know, just today, the day we're recording this podcast, the CDC has announced that we're going to go back to mask wearing. I think the caveats are indoors and in schools and things like that. So I wish I could be convincingly optimistic, but I don't think that we're at a place yet where we should be, you know, getting optimistic, I fear. And this is me without any hats on. This is just me as a human being based on the biases that I'm reading in whatever channels I read. I'd like to think that we could be full steam ahead. And there are many who are saying, yeah, wheels are open, let's go. And I applaud them for wanting to, but if they do it without regard for the seriousness of COVID and we continue to get more and more people infected, and we continue to see our audience dwindle because so many people are in hospital or sick, or so many people who are vaccinated are afraid to come to shows because they're hearing about things like the Delta variant breaking through the vaccine. It's not good. It's not a good outlook. I mean, your question may be more towards what are the best practices and protocols for COVID on the show site. Geez, part of me wants to say stay home. I know that's not what anybody wants to hear.
Yeah, I agree.
But we've got to get everybody vaccinated, and until we do, we've got to get everybody in masks and hand washing. You know, my daughter, everybody in this house is vaccinated except for my daughter, and that's because she's 9. And I'm super worried about that she can't have the vaccine yet, and that we're at soccer matches and we're at baseball matches and things like that.
And she's going to school in the next
six. Yeah, she's going to school. Yeah. That's exactly right. And we were just in Nashville. I was just in Nashville a week or so ago, and it was like Mardi Gras. It was like, there was mask. What's a mask? And while I applaud everybody's, and myself included, by the way, but, you know, I applaud everybody's tenacity in the face of this, but our industry is dangling by a very precarious thread right now. And while there are standard practices we can put in place, and most of them evolve around mask wearing, bubbles, and vaccines, much of the other stuff may be more about COVID theater, you know, about, you know, the idea, the perception that we're doing these other things that are helping to stave off COVID, that may not be doing anything. But if it's making the audience feel comfortable, or if it's making an artist feel comfortable that these things are happening, and that's their bias point, then let's do those things. But Foo Fighters, you know, that's not a new camp. That's not a camp that's doing things stupidly. That's a camp that knows what it's doing. And
agreed.
And here we are
with you know, management to back them up, for sure.
Yeah. And here we are. So if they can't get it right, you know, it's like Disney. If Disney can't get it right, you know, I don't know what to say about it. I really don't. I'm exhausted from the whole idea. As I know the audience is as well. And I wish there was something positive that we could spin, but I think that would be setting people up for failure.
Yeah. Agreed. Wow. I usually like to finish on a happy note.
Sorry. let's see. What can we talk about that's happy? I'll tell you what I'm hopeful for. I'm hopeful that during this time, all of the artists we all know and love, you know, regardless of what genre they're from or who they are, have written some incredible music. That's what I'm hopeful for.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to hear those things. And I can't wait until we are actually out of the woods on this, because I feel like many, we're back to the roaring 20s. I feel like it's going to be a hell of a party when we're out of this.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. We just
need to look after each other.
Yeah. Oh, you know what? Also, you know, I think on a positive note, I think, you know, a shout out should go to some of the very aware artists who have taken the steps to take care of the people close to them and have made, you know, public address announcements on vaccinations and making pleas to help Mike Strickland out with his journey to, you know, get everybody back in good standing. You know, there's a lot of good artists out there who have put their money where their mouth is and taking care of their crews. You know, not nearly enough, but you know, a shout out to, you know, people like Roger Waters and people like, you know, maybe, you know, the artist in Pearl Jam. And, you know, there's a lot of really, really happening artists out there who see the big picture and take care of their people, and they're to be commended.
Absolutely, they are. And as are the folks who are trying to get us started again. You know, I'm not by any means in any way admonishing anybody who's trying to get us going again. I think that we've got to keep trying it from every angle we can, and every format that we can, and every safety precaution that we can. And one of them's going to work. God, damn it. I hope, you know,
it will. For I mean, we're going to, you know, herd immunity is going to happen. Unfortunately, it's going to get there by vaccination and people getting sick.
Yeah.
But it will get there. You know, it will get there.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this. You know, I've learned a lot, you know. I mean, you know, they say when, you know, when you're, you know, in my position and you're doing an interview, you should, you know, always know the answers to the questions you're going to ask. Where I really didn't know many of the answers to the questions I've asked. So I learned some stuff and, you know, and I enjoyed the forum we did recently for the TPG.
I think so.
And yeah, and, you know, getting to know you a little bit better. So hopefully maybe one of these days we can sit down and chat about, you know, maybe chat about our kids or, you know, old war stories. You know, maybe we can show each other our scars or something.
Yeah. I'll tell you, that is maybe the happy note, right? COVID has made a whole lot of new relationships and made them for things that are not related to getting work. And I'm grateful that we got connected on all this, Chris. Like you said, yeah. I've heard your name forever, and I'm grateful for the work that you're doing, Matt, and for all the folks who have risen up and tried to take a piece of the problem and fix it. It's incredible to watch people doing that right now. So cool.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. You got anything for Jim, Matt?
Wow. I'll have to say that, you know, we've had a lot of amazing, great interviews and podcasts, but I would have to say that this is probably one of the most important ones. So thank you. That was great. And I think a lot of people are going to get out of it, a lot out of it. And I think it's going to wake them up and get them thinking deeply about this. And hopefully we can start seeing some shifts out there that, you know, basically yields good results as far as health and safety and all the things that really matter. So thank you, Jim.
Yeah. Well, and thank you guys for making room for more of the story to be told as opposed to just the talking points.
Right. Right. Yeah. The last time we, you know, we did that forum a couple of weeks ago, I remember everybody saying goodbye and signing off. And I hear you in the background going, self-care. And I think that is a wonderful way to sign off, you know, self-care, everybody.
Self-care. Yeah.
Right, man.
All right, Jim.
Matt, thanks for this, Jim.
Thank you.
I'll be seeing you soon, my friend.
Thank you, guys. I sure hope
so.
Bye. Thank you, Jim. See you, Chris. Thank you.